listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast with your host, Andy Plimer. Bringing you up-to-date coaching concepts from the world of rugby. Sharing ideas to make the game better.
Okay, welcome to episode number 57 of the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. I'm your host, Andy Plimer, and joining me today is Richard Shuttleworth. Richard has over 20 years coach education and support experience in elite level sport, focusing on skill acquisition. He has worked at the Australian Institute of Sport with Olympic level coaches, various national sport organisations, Super Rugby franchises, the NRL, Football Federation Australia, and Australian Rules Clubs. He was the professional coach development manager for the RFU for 4 years before moving into his latest role as a high performance coach development consultant. He has a BSc in coaching science, an MSc in sport psychology, and a PhD in skill acquisition. And it's a pleasure to have him on the show. So welcome, Richard.
Hi, Andy. It's great to be here, mate.
Yeah. Cheers for giving up some of your time. And obviously, with a resume like that, time is a precious resource.
It is when I'm trying to finish my PhD. I haven't quite got it.
Right. Okay. All right. all the best.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks, mate. I need it.
Yeah. Cool. So, what's a bit of a backstory for those who don't know, like your journey in terms of, early days playing rugby and then your introduction into coaching and so on.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's quite interesting just to sort of think back, to be honest, because I don't do it quite often, but. Growing up, I grew up in England, near Liverpool, and played mini rugby for a club called New Brighton.
Okay.
Really, really enjoyed it back in those days. I think it was under sixes, under sevens, right through till about I was 13, 14, and then we took off to go to Australia. And with my father, and I ended up playing schoolboy rugby for Brisbane State High in Brisbane. Mm-hmm. And really enjoyed it. Yeah, it was just a contrast in lifestyle. Played a lot more sports over there than I did when I was back in England as a school kid. So, it was interesting, and it was probably a good background for specialising later on. And so we then moved after school. I moved to New Zealand and played rugby out there in Canterbury. I played a year with the Canterbury under 21s.
Wow.
Played Premiership rugby out there for about three or four years, and then after that went back to Australia. My dream was to play for the Wallabies, and I was a number seven,
as it should be everyone's dream.
It was, mate. You know, watching the Ella brothers and everybody like that, the way they played rugby back in the day was a dream for me to try and be part of that at some stage, but. You know, I wasn't blessed with the height, and I didn't have a massive stature. So played number seven, but there was still a place for me. I played club rugby at Souths in Brisbane and then Queensland Uni. Coach was Chris Roach back then, you know, the former number seven Wallaby, and he got me in there and believed in me. And but at that time, Bob Dwyer was coaching. I think they were looking for some pretty tall back rows then at the back of the line out. Yeah. So. You know, we couldn't cut the height thing. I had a couple of injuries by then with my knees. And I was playing in the back row with a fellow called Matt Taylor, who's the Scottish defence coach right now. Tats.
Okay,
Matt
Taylor. He had a good weekend.
He was in the back row with me actually at Souths.
Oh, great.
So I keep in touch with him. He's a really good mate. And I sort of took off then and went to Hong Kong and thought I'd enjoy my rugby and played for the national team out there for, 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. I played for a couple of clubs, Hong Kong Football Club, and then moved to Kowloon because they gave me free beer.
Of course.
Yeah, just loved it.
Yeah.
Played, and then ended up coaching, I think it was the women's sevens, and then I started to work my way up through the junior grades, and then the Hong Kong national team I did for a couple of years with another guy, another coach from New Zealand, and enjoyed it. And that's the start of my coaching, really. I sort of got into it then.
And what were those early experiences like coaching?
You're in obviously Hong Kong, and I thought, you know, it was a transition for me. It was a natural transition because I was quite a thinker about the game. And being a number seven, sort of my sort of role model back in the early days was Jean-Pierre Reeves. I used to have a videotape of him, and a VHS video back in the day, and I used to play it again and again and watch him train himself, you know, do these like drills by himself. And I did that for most of my career. When I started coaching, I sort of really critically analyzed the game, and I was like that when I started coaching, and I was probably overly technical when I was in Hong Kong. And I had a very good friend I played with in the football club called Roger Patterson. He was a Kiwi guy, played for New Zealand universities and a rep player. And he pulled me aside after about 6 months of coaching the club team, which were most of my mates were in the team. And he sort of said, Rick, you know, what you're doing, what's got to do with the game? He said, you've got this drill going. And I'd thought about it too much. It basically overthought it. And it was so removed from the actual game that he was good enough to tell me and be honest with me. And I actually then changed from that day onwards. He just planted the seed in my head. And from then on, I got interested in sort of skill acquisition, to be honest, and went on a journey from there. But I sort of started to research some papers myself in Hong Kong. At the same time, my boss was a fellow called George Simpkin from New Zealand who invented, you remember the first yellow kicking tee?
Yeah,
he was a bit of a legend, and he was in Hong Kong. He coached the national team in the sevens, and he was my boss at the Hong Kong Rugby Union because I sort of was coaching executive there, running level one, two, and three. And that was my experience. I had to sort of write these manuals, and I sort of leant towards New Zealand and Australia for most of the content. And George just said to me one day, come on, let's go up to China. Let's develop some rugby up there. Because the IRB weren't really over there at that stage, I didn't think. We traveled around China, PLA Army, up to Shanghai, running almost the first coaching course in China up in Shenyang.
Oh, that's amazing.
Had like 30 Chinese guys who couldn't speak English, and they all had guts on them, and they were smoking and were wearing Man United T-shirts.
They fit right in.
I loved it. I just absolutely loved it. But anyway, that was the start of my coaching career, to be honest.
Yeah, and then you moved into academia, and like we mentioned at the beginning, you're just wrapping up your PhD in skill acquisition. What was that journey like? How was that in New Zealand that you were studying initially, and how was that?
Well, really, to be honest, when I was in Hong Kong, I was there for 7 years, and I sort of came to this realization: if I stay here, you know, I'm not going to go any further. So I took off and went to England and did a master's in sports psychology, and met Keith Davids, and he changed my way of thinking. I'd read a couple of his papers in Hong Kong, and he changed my way of thinking. And I was heading that way anyway, but he really turned the wheel for me, and he supported what was inside my head at that stage. And you know, he also sort of stretched my thinking as well. So I pursued a PhD with him down at Otago University down in New Zealand. I shot down there, you know, at that time in my life, you know, life's a journey. So I don't think twice about opportunities. I just say yes. And then I'm thinking, shit, I'm off to New Zealand next week. So
got to work this out.
I love New Zealand anyway, the people, the country. So it was a great opportunity to go back and then, you know, exercise my mind rather than just my body. So I coached down there. I was coaching the Otago Uni Prem team, and I did some junior grade under 18s Otago, and whilst also studying. And it gave me the opportunity to like put theory into practice whilst I was working and lecturing for Keith Davids. So I was really fortunate for 3 to 4 years being down there, exposed to the latest research and theory whilst also coaching sort of high level rugby. We were fortunate to have about 3 or 4 All Blacks in our team. And just the average level of a New Zealand rugby player, club rugby, is pretty high. You know, and their mentality and their mindsets, they're always passionate and they train, and so for me it was a fantastic opportunity. And at that time I had to make a choice to pursue a professional career in coaching, which I wanted to do, or pursue sports science career in lecturing. And I wanted to actually pursue the pro coaching, but New Zealand didn't pay money at that stage and I couldn't quite afford it. So I just carried on doing some rep stuff. But really the PhD was the key thing for me. And I was learning from Keith, and I was having sort of semi-regular visits with the Otago coaches. And Wayne Smith used to come down, check up on some of the All Blacks. And we used to sit down, and that was my first moment where I was actually starting to apply my theory at a sort of a higher level with a coach, obviously, who's well recognized. Yeah, but what I started to realize was the ability of someone like Wayne to understand and pick up theory and have a way of transferring it into his practice. And doing it with an understanding of why he was doing it, you know, and that was something to me that struck a chord with these Kiwi coaches, is how curious they were. You know, if there was one thing to say about, you know, if you're going to be a good coach, well, you sort of will be curious in terms of how you can improve and the theory behind your practice. And so that was the start of me really looking at dynamical systems.
Yeah, right.
And self-organization in a team sport. That probably would have been about 2003, I think.
Right. So dynamical systems, like I know it like from Franz Bosch with running. He uses like broomsticks to exaggerate the knee lift to teach that component of the skill. How would dynamical systems theory look in a rugby kind of setting?
Going to the Franz Bosch thing, I think that's almost a splinter from the original concepts, like Scott Kelso, who looked at complex dynamic systems. So dynamical systems has been around for a long time, and when it's moved into humans and biological systems, the Russian Bernstein started to pioneer, which he was a physiologist, psychologist. He was an interdisciplinary sports scientist in Russia. And his stuff didn't get published in early days because I think it was a little bit sort of perturbing or threatening to the Russian system at that stage.
Right.
So a lot of his stuff was unpublished, but it eventually came out. It's been translated and stuff. And that sort of turned into what we know as dynamical systems. Scott Kelso has done some groundbreaking stuff, and he works probably more in the neuro level now.
Okay.
But essentially, those concepts of a complex adaptive system, self-organizing constraints, and mixing in with ecological psychology has formed what we have ecological dynamics. But the dynamic systems in team sports, you know, there was some researchers starting to look at that in team sports early on. And Keith Davids was, in the early days, was, I think, ahead in his mindset and his thinking. He may not have done some studies that are currently out there right now, but the thinking and the theory was there. And he sort of branched off with Carl Newell and used this constraints model, which uses these concepts of dynamic systems, constraints interacting. And it's all about interaction. It's about the relationships between components and how they self-organize under constraints.
Yeah.
So when you look at a team sport, you could look at players as components or parts of that complex adaptive system. And the constraints could be anything from space to the boundaries to what the purpose and the rules and regulations are and the equipment that you use. So the constraints model as we now know it, which a lot of these practitioners are imparting in their practice, has dynamical systems, concepts and principles that underpin it. But maybe a lot of coaches and practitioners don't truly understand those. So my advice would be is you go back and you actually look at those fundamental principles and look at them outside of rugby and outside of sport as well. And then when you go back into the sport, you also almost have this perspective on how you could look at the sport, how you could intervene to train skill. So, yeah, dynamical systems sort of merged with ecological psychology. So Carl Newell, Keith Davids, a fellow called Gert Savelsberg, who was there during my master's. He did things like perception action, mm-hmm. and that was the essence of that constraints framework, the dynamic systems framework that sort of shifted my sort of thinking in those early days. And one other person, Esther Thielen, was in motor learning, motor development. And I think that's a big area that a lot of coaches or even sports science practitioners, pracademics don't sort of mention or consider. And she did some groundbreaking stuff with manipulating constraints in motor development. And if you go back and look at that sort of stuff, that to me is the fundamental essence of coaching, is motor learning and motor development. But you're just doing it in a sport-specific environment. So I'd say those four sort of people for me, and then mixing in with ecological dynamics is a fellow called Duarte Rouge from Portugal. And he did his PhD down at Otago Uni. He was finishing that the same time I got down there in 2004. And you may know Duarte's research, but he's really pushed the boundaries and he does some fantastic stuff. I used to share a couple of years just chatting with him down at the university in Otago, talking because he was interested in sailing. Mm-hmm. I ended up working with the Australian sailing team when I was at the AIS. We had basic similar ideas about dynamic systems in sport. So from that point onwards, I was sort of shaped that way. And my coaching reflected it. So when I coached the premiership team in Otago, and I think I coached the Otago 16s and 18s, I think, in 2 years, I used to use a dynamic systems approach, yeah. which was quite, because I had students in the university team, they're very open-minded, they're very academically minded, they're thinkers. Mm. And I think a university team is a great sort of sample group to try this stuff with. And, you know, we got to the grand final doing it. But the fact was that we did things differently. Mm. We had a lot of games where where the players were having to find their own way through these games. There wasn't a lot of structure in it whatsoever, and we went through stages where I learned how players perceive and react in certain situations. What it allowed me to do though is Otago 16s and 18s was actually start this process where I used chaos games for my selection. So I didn't go on previous people who were selected in the age groups below and then trial those guys. I basically didn't want to know any of their names, what schools they came from. And me and my assistant coach, we basically played these chaos games and selected a team out of what we thought were people who could be quite effective and skilled in certain situations. We selected this team and... You know, we used to get a lot of phone calls from parents about my team. My son's been in the Otago team for 3 years.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But I had the full support of the Otago Rugby Union. And it was fantastic, mate. Absolutely fantastic. And we took them to the South Island, New Zealand tournament. We ended up winning it. I used the same method for the 18s, Otago 18s. And we played in Tri-Nations tournament against Queensland and Canterbury, and we did the same thing and just a higher level, and it was great to see that work in a shorter space of time as well that we had with these blokes. So look, I think that was just exploring really, and I felt safe exploring because people like Wayne Smith was doing it at the All Black level and the Canterbury level. So if someone like that can demonstrate those qualities, then it gives you confidence to think, I'm going to try stuff out with my players. And you've got three or four All Blacks in the team. You sort of prime them a little bit beforehand and say, look, you know, you may need to support me in a few things here and give a bit of leadership within the team because we're going to challenge, you know, the way we do things. And to be honest, the Kiwi guys were fantastic. And, you know, you obviously make mistakes, but you learn a lot as well. And, I think the results sort of spoke for themselves in terms of training outcomes, competition, people very competitive, but we expressed ourselves in term, and we changed the game back then. Like, there were no rolling malls again in, back in then. And this bloke goes, crikey, why don't we just do rolling malls off the back of this line out when they're not expecting it? And I think we scored 13 tries back in 2005 or six with these Islanders at the back of every line out. He scored 13 tries. Like, he was gloating with it, but nobody stopped us until other teams adapted to it, and then we would change. So I guess we took pride in changing before other teams could. And the boys took pride in that, meant, you know, thinking about the game tactically. So
I really just wanted to backtrack a bit to that, the chaos game. So I really like that idea. You know, I think it's it could be a lot of fun from a coaching point of view, but also for the players. What could you try and articulate, like, an example of what that might look like? What, like a 10-minute game, and how that would look, and how you'd sell it to the players or lay it out to the players and go from there?
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some principles, I guess, when you implement a more sort of constraints learning approach. You know, we can go through those. I've got some down here for you. But generally, you're looking at players to self-organize. How well are they going to self-organize? If you go down a more traditional approach, Andy, you'd be looking at having a team that's got more of a hierarchy and it's following a model or a template. So we threw that out the window and basically looked at the players as a blank sheet. And we played a game where there's very little structure to it, but basically you put in a couple of parameters. And so we basically picked three teams of, say, 7, 8, or 9. And it's just a continuous game where one team starts in the middle. They're facing another team and they kick the ball to them, and then they have to defend. And the team attacking, who's receiving the ball, has got two phases to break the line. And after those two phases, if they have or they haven't, they still then take the ball through the defense and kick the ball to the other third team who's waiting at the other end. And they defend that team. So it's a continuous three-team game. And that formed a core of my game structures. And then you can add different parameters and constraints into that. So effectively, like, the two phase was great, because what it essentially does, over time, you can see players adapt and self-organize. And it's got everything from the initial breakdown to which side are you going to attack, how do you position yourself, what sort of depth and width do you go, what line speed, what communication, where are you going to scan, are you going to scan the ball, scan the defense. It virtually has everything in it. And you don't have time to sort of pre-plan. So if you go down this approach, you've got to give minimal time for pre-planning, because that will be more sort of, you know, pre-judgment decision-making.
Doesn't happen on the field.
Yeah, well, it can when you have time. And I think, you know, your more leaders who may be marshalling you around the pitch have obviously got that sort of strategy in mind. But very, very few times are when you're in unstructured play can you do that. So what we wanted to do was train with 80% unstructuredness. And this was back in early 2000s, because the game was like that. And I think Wayne had a high priority that with Canterbury and the All Blacks back then. Picked up on things like that, and they lent themselves to dynamical systems. So I played chaos games, and I'd call that chaos because, you know, these blokes are there going, well, where do you want us to go? Well, it depends in terms of what the pitch is going to be in about half a second time. So I'd, you know, the things I'd say to the players was, look, what I recommend you do is keep scanning. As the breakdown's happening, look where the defense are positioning themselves, and that's going to give you a clue to where you're going to go. So we went away from cues to clues back in the early 2000s, because people were always looking for cues. What's the cue? And it acted as a stimulus response, which I didn't want. I didn't want to cue people in. I just wanted people to find out where to scan, where to look for clues to know what to do next. So I use chaos games basically as a foundation to give clues.
Those clues, you could probably look at it from a perception action coupling system there too, right?
Yeah, absolutely, mate. So, you know, the modern spin on it is perception action, but the beautiful thing about it is it's very dynamic. It evolves, and it's not static. If you look stimulus response or reaction time, traditional information processing testing, it's quite artificial. It's artificial stimulus driven, almost like change of direction instead of agility these days. You know, you're bringing perception in, but I don't think it should be a predetermined cue. I believe wholeheartedly that it needs to be interpreted in terms of meaningful information that's relevant to your next action. And you have to interpret that. You have to perceive that if it's going to be an opportunity for you or for your teammates. And that's the element of decision making, I think, we didn't quite understand, or sometimes still don't.
Okay, so after New Zealand, you ended up at the Australian Institute of Sport. Can you talk a little bit about what your role was there, moving probably away from rugby, more into Olympic sports?
Yeah, I moved over there to work with a colleague, Damien Farrow.
Absolutely.
Who a lot of people know. And Damien, I forged a good working relationship with him, who he was sort of heading up skill acquisition back in Australia at that stage. And his work was with people like Bruce Abernethy on contextual interference and a different interpretation on variability from dynamical systems. But I think we sort of complemented, or hopefully I complemented the Damien and other colleagues there with a slightly different perspective, but we had similar outcomes in terms of skill acquisition. And so the other people were Adam Gorman and David Mann. So we comprised almost, and Melissa Phillips, we comprised skill acquisition. And Damien had done a fair bit of work already with AFL, I think, and tennis, and quite a few other sports. And so I worked on sort of more of a dynamic systems approach with a range of sports, from Australian sailing to indoor sprint cycling, anemias, and then archery, canoe slalom, kayak. I think we had the Aussie Sevens team with Michael O'Connor. So four years with Michael O'Connor, which was fantastic.
Yeah,
so, you know, therefore rugby comes back again, and you can continue on with your theory in that. So working across the sports, I think the biggest learning for me was applying a dynamical systems and ecological psychology into individual sports and team sports. And that was the challenge for me at that stage, because there wasn't anyone that I knew at that stage, you know, really to share information with me. So I tried out lots of different methods, and that then carried through to the performance of the sports that I was working with, and you know, learning how to work with coaches was the biggest thing, to get their trust, understand their philosophy first and foremost, and don't go imposing your theory on somebody. I think it's the key thing. And yeah,
that bit of a drip feed kind of approach to it.
Yes, definitely the nudge theory. So I think you start to understand that I see what this coach is trying to do, and you can sit back a little bit and you learn how to observe. You learn how the environment is quite key on the coach trying to get some outcomes, and that's when you can start to work with them and you know, offer some suggestions in terms of, have you thought about this? I think it was about 6 or 7 years of doing that, and you know, working outside as well with World Cup sports, you know, rugby union, rugby league, and AFL. So we had a great time. Particularly Adam Gorman and myself, we used to share an office, particularly with the Australian women's water polo team, where we had a project, and it was about for 8 weeks to improve their skills in shooting. And dynamic team decision making. So, yeah, we worked on a whiteboard where we almost use a systems, dynamic systems approach, and we planned out everything that we were going to do. And that was a massive learning for me and him in terms of how you can periodize, how you can plan to use these concepts of self-organization, variability, constraints, perception, action in Olympic sport. I mean, you know, we're talking the high level here, that if you go in there and someone goes, what the hell are you doing? You've got to know why you're doing something, and you've got to know what you're manipulating and what the purpose is. And that for us was to me, was setting me up for my next phase, I guess, when I went to the England Rugby Union.
Yeah, so yeah, that's perfect segue. So what was that like? Where you were the professional coach development manager there for 4 years. What was your day-to-day activities like in the office, on the field? And can you talk us through a little bit of those experiences? Because I think you were there during the Lancaster time and then the transition to Eddie Jones, right?
That's right. Yeah.
It was during
periods, yeah.
So I
got there in about 2013.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, beginning of 2013. I was invited over to the Olympic Games, and I was with the canoe slalom, and I was over there, and I knew Kevin Bowring, who was the head of professional coach development for England Rugby, RFU. Right. He invited me in to do a skill acquisition module for level four, and I did it. And at that time, there was a change in personnel, and he asked if I was interested to do this position. And one thing led to another, and within a few months, I was in England as professional coach development manager.
Great.
You know, he knew I had a rugby background, so and skill acquisition. But the key focus for him to move coaching forward was to shift an emphasis towards learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where I made a decision that I was going to focus on that in terms of what my role was. I spent four really great years working with coaches implicitly around the theme of learning and learning to learn. So I brought skill acquisition, which is really learning, learning skill within the rugby environment and within the culture of English rugby. My role was to support the coaches in the national pathway. So England 16s, 18s, 20s. Through to the seniors, and there are national high performance coaches which are already established. So you've got John Fletcher, Peter Walton, and then we had Nick Walsh back then, who was leading the 20s.
Right. And they had some success too in the Junior World Cup.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think it was back in 2013, if memory serves me right. So my role was to support those coaches. And there was an alignment of philosophy and ideas that was emanating bottom up and top down. Mm. So obviously Stuart was there at that time. They sort of went down a track with, I think, at Matt Parker at that stage. And they were gearing up for a World Cup. So my focus primarily was with Nick Walsh in the under 20s. And they did really well over in New Zealand. They won a World Cup down there.
Yeah.
Yeah, John Fletcher has very successful with his guys coming through and really creating an environment where the young players can learn and express their skills and learn new ways of moving and passing and kicking. And I think that was the strength of that pathway and how it all connected. And I just pretty much supported that and challenged these guys and stretched them to learn a bit more and just add value. But I think probably the biggest thing for me, Andy, was focusing more around the 20s and getting a connection there, because our motto was to help develop some of the best players who could self-organize on the pitch, could make decisions, could adapt and play any system, any structure at any club. And can win a World Cup. So if we're looking at that sort of player, we want world-class players like that. We're going to have world-class coaches.
Yeah, absolutely.
And absolutely. So therefore, I mean, everyone in the pathway was behind that in terms of our international performance coaches. It looks different for John Fletcher and Rusty as it would do, say, for a 20s coach, as it would do for the senior coach. Mm-hmm. But the principles remain the same. And the how to coach starts to become quite important. And that was perhaps neglected in most coaching pathways around the world. You don't often see how to coach in a lot of qualifications or even in CPD. So we worked heavily on that. Fletch was brilliant, and Nick Walsh superseded Ian Peel, who's now the Saracens forwards coach. I worked with him for a few years, and he was magnificent, a very smart forwards coach. You know, you're talking about a forwards coach. This bloke, you know, played rugby up at Newcastle with Fletch, actually. But, you know, he was exposed to people like All Blacks who were heading up, Carl Heyman.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Australia. So his way of thinking was challenged from the norm. And because he's smart and thinks about the game, he had many different perspectives about making decisions. It wasn't just the coach. It wasn't just structure. So we had a platform there to work off, and you know, they won 3 out of 4 World Cups in those 4 years.
Yeah.
And the last year culminated in Rory Teague taking over. He coached with Martin Haag.
Okay.
And that was probably my last year. It was my last year, and it was probably my happiest year, to be honest, just to sort of see things come together and actually see the players play in the way they did in Manchester in that 20s World Cup.
Yeah.
Culmination of what all those coaches have done in the pathway, but Martin Haag and Rory Teague creating an environment where those players could actually express themselves and play unscripted, actually play what was in front of them.
Yeah.
And ball movement and everything was just a recognition of what those coaches had put into place. And I think that was proof enough for me.
Yeah.
That things were working, and you know, credit to the coaches, and I keep in touch with all those guys because you go on a journey together, you learn, you develop. It's about trust. It's about nurturing people, players. It's getting to know who they are. And I didn't want to get in the way of anybody. I was just there to support the coaches to make better decisions. And, you know, they knew that. And that's why I really enjoyed working with Nick Walsh, Ian Peel, Rory Teague and Fletch and Rusty. And it's moved on a bit now. And, you know, I moved out, and then I sort of do some stuff with Eddie Jones now and the contract there. So that's my focus now.
Yeah, well, so that's your new role, right, with the high performance coach development consultancy that you're doing now. And again, you're back in rugby, which is awesome. And you know, working at the top end, what's that like? How's that different to, you know, the working at the RFU compared to consulting, and what's that kind of look like when you go in and you're assisting Eddie and other coaches?
Oh, it's really good. It's obviously different. You know, it's this thing between development. People draw comparisons between development coaching or high performance. And my philosophy has always been in skill acquisition is that you develop high performance. You know, you learn to perform. So it's almost a continuum for me where you may place emphasis on development or learning to perform, and then you may place more emphasis on performing in the moment.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't get caught up in dichotomies or this versus that. It just holds you back. But if you understand the principles that underpin it, that allows you to work more functionally and effectively. And I think being a consultant, it freed me up now to be able to reconnect with Keith Davids, conduct some more research and push the boundaries in terms of how I apply myself through my role as a consultant. So working with Steve Borthwick, primarily supporting him in driving his needs and supporting his needs. And they would be very individual specific to Steve, and based on what his intended outcomes are with Eddie Jones, you know, and obviously that's geared around the World Cup, but it's also geared around those coaches improving before the World Cup to be able to coach the players to have the skills to be able to perform on that stage. And, you know, they've planned all that out. That's their process for me is to support, you know, those coaches. And And obviously, Paul Gustard, Neil Hatley, they're all very good thinkers about the game. I think Eddie obviously leads that. You know, that they've got other guys like Dean Benton, as you know, and Neil Craig's recently come in. That environment there is almost trying to maximize the way it works to be effective. So that coaching group has to maximize or optimize itself in a way to be able to coach these players to be self-organizers, to make decisions, to adapt. And I guess helping Steve and, you know, the chats I have with Guz and Hats are all around sort of those very similar issues which will be to how can the players be more adaptive or more effective in certain situations. And that can be at an individual player level or a collective level. At the collective level, it tends to be more around tactical periodization, which Eddie has introduced with, you know, with a focus on the S&C, of course, as you know. And Dean and Tom Tomlinson and Tweets drive a lot of that. But it's definitely an interconnected approach and framework, which, funnily enough, Ernie, has emanated from dynamical systems. It's almost like a full circle, isn't it? But it can get applied in different ways. And I think it depends on the understanding of the practitioners. If they know it well, it can be applied well. If they don't, sometimes it can be quite difficult.
Cool. Well, that sounds pretty exciting. And, obviously a new direction for you. And it sounds like you're having an absolute ball with it.
Yeah, really enjoying it. I mean, you've got to just say, look, you know, you're living the dream, you're enjoying it. Yeah. And I wouldn't do anything else. But, you know, the money's a big factor. You've got to, at this time in my life, you've got to think, you've just been with a coach, you've worked with him for 2-3 years, and now he's earning 300,000 somewhere, you know, over in another country. Yeah, and then you're still doing the same thing.
Yeah,
but to the next guy, you know, and I wouldn't have it any other way, to be honest, but, you know, you start to get paid in terms of coaches coming back to you and giving you feedback later on, and they might have tried something out and that you may have mentioned to them a few years back. And that's the happiness about it. That's the returns and the feedback that you get that, you know, you wouldn't get anywhere else, really.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Cool. All right, well, we always end the show with the same four questions. When you were a kid growing up, I suppose in England, Australia, New Zealand, this might be a tricky one for you. Who was one of your favourite players or multiple players that you really liked watching when you were a youngster?
Yeah, when I was a young fella, I think I said before, I had a VHS videotape of Jean-Pierre Reeves.
Yeah.
Long blonde hair, which I sort of had back in those days. You know, I had longer hair. I had long blonde hair. He was my absolute hero, you know, playing for France. Yeah, he always got cuts, and his hair ended up red at the end of every Six Nations game because of blood. And I heard he used to drink champagne in the hotel the night before his match. So, you know, he was my hero. But more recently, when I was living in Australia, I just loved Stephen Larkin.
Yeah,
just,
me too, yeah.
And George Gregan, to be honest, as well. But Stephen Larkin, just absolutely fantastic. Yeah. And a top-notch fella as well, isn't he? I guess really recently is Hooper, probably. Michael Hooper.
Yeah, that's my next one. Yeah, who are the ones going around now? And yeah, Michael Hooper's just he's an absolute horse. The amount of work he gets through, he's got to be in the top 1% of players in terms of work rate and motor. Yeah.
And not just that, I think he's so driven, isn't he? He's so intent, and his decision making and the way he reads and anticipates, it's fantastic. You know, the way he applies himself in every game, just love it.
Yeah, no, I think what stands out for me too, there was a bit of video going around with just his on-field leadership as well, just how he talks to his players, how he talks to the referees. It's superb.
Yeah.
All right. What about coaching? Who's a high profile coach or coaches that you like what they're doing or have enjoyed working with in the past?
I guess I'll come back to just my experience here more recently with the 20s and Rory, who's moved to Bordeaux Beagles. Just to see the improvements in a coach so quickly. He's obviously going to be tested out now in the position he's in, but to see somebody believe in something or believe in certain principles and then apply them with great belief at the high level yet to see if it proves itself, but he did it with the 20s, helped with Eddie, and I think Rory has been an absolute privilege to work with in that environment. So you know, he's one of these high level coaches that I'm sure will actually go, you know, the full distance and have great success, because I think his philosophy and his ideas about the game are going to not only suit France, because he's over there and he speaks French and he understands the culture, but also getting the best out of skillful players, improving players, growing the players and actually possibly changing the game and the way we see the game, an innovator, a changer. And it unsettles some people, I think.
Yeah.
But that's what you possibly need, particularly in France, maybe, as well.
Well, if you can achieve it there, he's on the right track, eh?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. Look, he'll be one of those coaches who I put up there, yeah.
Great, awesome. Definitely keep an eye on Bordeaux and their performances. And what about someone maybe that is lesser known that you think is doing great work and deserves a shout-out?
Matt Taylor, mate, coach of Scotland.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Well, he's up there, of course, mate. But
yeah,
he surprises me because he's the sort of guy that you talk to and you think, Christ, he's still coaching under-10s by the way he's speaking, you know, because he's so unassuming. And I love it, you know. It's hi, Rich, what have you got, mate? Yeah. What can I learn, you know? And awesome. You forget who you're speaking to. So that's what I love about some of these coaches. And I just think Tats is a shining example of that. And he's up in Scotland. He's an Aussie, but he's got Scottish heritage. And those are the sort of blokes you don't forget where they come from. And, you know, I really like that. He could be down coaching under 16s or 12s one day. And I must say the same for Steve Borthwick. These people have a passion for developing people. And rugby is just a byproduct almost. I know we shouldn't say that, but you're actually developing a person who happens to play rugby and using rugby as the vehicle. So I'm sure with these coaches, you get players who become, you know, real bastions for the game. They become, you know, top blokes, and great respects and good friendships with them. And Steve's one of those guys who would talk to an individual for hours afterwards to help him, and you know, Rory and Matt Taylor and obviously Gregor and these sort of people, they do that. And I think that's a big part of coaching, and allowing players to have fun and enjoy themselves. And I think we shouldn't forget that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I totally agree. All right, Rich, well, thanks so much for giving up your time. This has been a great one. I just brought a new notepad today, and I've just written all over a number of pages, so you've given me a lot of homework to check out myself for my own development. So, you know, I really want to thank you for coming on the show and giving up your time, and look forward to chatting again sometime soon.
A real pleasure, Andy. Really enjoyed it. Thanks very much, mate.
Yeah, no worries. Perfect. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Rugby Coaches Corner podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a review via iTunes and keep listening for the next episode. You can also follow us via Twitter at RugbyCoachesCNR or via the website therugbycoachescorner.com. Until next time, keep sharing ideas to make the game better.